We'll call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order at 1:08 p.m. We just finished up our floor session, so folks might be eating and transitioning here. We'll expect other members to join us shortly. Members present at this time, Representative Chris Birch, Representative Justin Parrish, Representative Dave Tallarico, Vice Chair Representative Dean Westlake, Co-Chair Andy Josephson, and myself, Representative Garen Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast, and our LIO moderator, Summers Cole. Thank you to both of you for your work to help us out. Before we get started, if we could please ask members of the committee as well as in the audience to silence your cell phones. We'd appreciate that. Before the committee this afternoon are confirmation hearings for AGDC and also the commissioner for the Department of Natural Resources. And then we'll take up House Bill 155, Alaska Mental Health Trust Land Exchange, sponsored by Rep. Ortiz. So at this time, we'll start with the AGDC appointees. And so we have Mr. Hugh Short and Mr. Warren Christensen. And I'll let you two decide which one of you wants to go first. And so if you could please join us. And everyone should have their biography and resume information in their packets. But if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and what makes you interested in this board, we'll let you introduce yourself, and then we'll take questions from committee members.
Thank you, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. members of the committee. For the record, my name is Warren Christian. I've lived in Alaska for over 40 years. I'm from North Pole. I've also lived in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Nenana. I have worked in the oil and gas industry for over 30 years, specializing in Arctic pipeline construction. I started off as a welder helper and worked my way up through the company till finally becoming president. For the last 10 years, I've worked for Doyon Associated. It's a partnership between Doyon Limited and Associated Pipeline Company. Prior to that, I worked for Houston Contracting. I was the president of that company, and that company is a pipeline company owned by Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. I've had the great opportunity to work on many pipeline projects on the North Slope in the planning and development of them, projects such as Alpine, Badami, North Star, Meltwater, Tarn, Exxon's Point Thompson project, ConocoPhillips' CD5 project, and that's just to name a few. I also worked on the 9-mile reroute of the 48-inch TAPS pipeline in Attican Pass. I've also been involved in the training of Alaskans. I am a trustee of the Joint Apprenticeship Training Committee for the Plumbers and Pipefitters. I'm also a trustee and secretary for the Fairbanks Pipeline Training Center. I'm a member of the Alliance, the RDC, and the Fairbanks Chamber. I'm a certified project management professional and a certified welding instructor. Inspector, not instructor. Currently, I serve on the technical committee for the AGDC, where I actively engage with the management team.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just like to thank you for your interest and willingness to serve on this committee. Great background experience. What do you see as the top three challenges you know facing this project? I mean, obviously, there's you know it's been in the public view, and that's you know first and foremost in the minds of many of us. Can you speak to that, or are you in a position to speak to that?
Through the chair, Representative Birch. Yes, the one you're going to hear a lot of is the commercial side, and that's, of course, the cost of the project, the market, and also the financing. But I'm going to add two others to that. You know, if we get over that first hurdle, another major challenge that we're going to have for the state of Alaska is the training of Alaskans. Mm-hmm. If you look at the schedule for this project, it ramps up extremely quick. And most of the crafts that will work on this project, you don't learn that craft or master that craft in a year. It takes several years to do that. So the overall plan that we need to develop for training Alaskans needs to be done way in advance and thought of way in advance before this project gets on the ground. Otherwise, the Alaskans won't be trained in time in order to work on the project. The third one is another one that's dear to my heart. It's during not only during construction but also during the planning and permitting phase is the safety of the workforce mm-hmm. and the public. And when we built the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, 32 people lost their lives, and that will not be acceptable building this project at all. So we need to make sure that we implement the highest safety standards and safety procedures in not only the execution part but also the planning and the permitting phase.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Please let the record reflect that Representative Rauscher and Representative Drummond and Representative Johnson have joined us. So we have a full committee. Mr. Christian just introduced himself and his background and experience in working in the oil and gas industry, and so we had just started with committee questions. Any other questions from committee members? Representative Tallarico.
I was just curious. Did I hear you say you lived in Nenana?
For when I was younger, for a couple of years, yes.
Okay, so you're a Lynx. That's what you're telling me.
Be the chair. Oh, pardon me?
Black and gold, the Lynx.
Junior high.
Oh, okay. That was it, Madam Chair. I'm just...
Okay.
I'm a blue and gold Tri-Valley guy, but I don't want to harbor that again.
Good to have friendly rivalry, right? Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Christian, what do you see as the project's viability at this point in time, and what future investments should the legislature continue to make in the project as you see it?
Through the chair, Senator Josephson, I mean, Representative Josephson, the project's viability based on the Wood Mackenzie report, they gave us a path forward to get this job or this project into the commercial range. Those items are, of course, the third-party tolling and the third-party finance, along with the federal exemption for taxes for state ownership. That's the path we're on right now. And our model that's being created, which will be disseminated to the legislature, is going to represent that and the assumptions around those items. So I see there is a path forward, and it's challenging. We have a lot of work to do, but we can get there. The future investment, the permitting is going to take some time. Once we file the permit, we'll have 18 months before they issue a record of decision. That's going to take us beyond our fiscal year 2018. So our funding right now and our budget takes us through the end of our fiscal year 2018. After that, we're going to probably come back and need some more funding to complete the permitting process.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you see any viable alternatives to the gas pipeline in terms of getting our gas to market?
Be the chair, Representative Parrish. At this time, I'm relatively new to the board and all the data, so I've been swamped with binders and binders of stuff just to get up to speed. From what I've seen from the work that's been done on the project, it's massive, and they've done an excellent job in the routing, the estimates, their assumptions. At this current time, I don't see an alternative that we would get complete in time for us to be anywhere near the middle of 2020 range.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Christian, I was wondering, I see here you sat on the board of ANGDA.
Yes, sir.
Correct?
Yes.
And so I guess with that in mind from your past and where you're headed now, how do you view what you've learned there and where we're headed now and in respect to each other, if you understand where I'm going with that?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher. First of all, my term on ANGDA was very short.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was there for like 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
I finished out somebody else's term there at ANGDA. It's a different approach. That approach was trying to market gas, just gas without an LNG plant, and a gas treatment plant. Mm-hmm. This project here is much larger in scope. Mm-hmm. And as far as the differences, it's a completely different path. With the owner companies, when they formed the Alaska LNG, they've done quite a bit more work than I've seen on any project that's been done to date. I mean, a tremendous amount of work, including optimization studies. So they've done a great amount of work. So this project, from my perspective, is a lot farther than anything we've ever done before.
Any follow-up, Representative Rauscher?
And I got here late. I apologize. So I don't know what was asked before. So I'm just going to take a shot at it. The challenges here now, they're big. And do you see us overcoming them, and how do you see us overcoming them? We know that investors, we know all kinds of things that we're going to have to be looking at. And I was wondering, how do you see us overcoming all of those challenges?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, there is quite a bit of challenges on this project right now. From my perspective, and once again, I've only been here for a very short period of time, but the most important thing that we need to complete is the FERC process. We have $600 million worth of data. That FERC process will validate that data. That permit will be good for 3 years, and we can probably get an extension an additional 2 years after that. That gives us a ready, shelf-ready project. So if the market does change, or if we can't validate our assumptions and our model here in the next year, and the market does change 3 years from now, we can pull this off the shelf and we'd be ready to go. So I think the challenges are there. I think within a short period of time, by the end of next year, we will know for sure whether we can validate those assumptions we have in the new model.
Any additional follow-up, Representative Rauscher? And you came in just as we started with questions, so you didn't miss any of the questions, but you did miss his introduction of himself and his background.
Okay, I guess I do have one more. So strategically, how do you view our state's position right now, sitting where we're at, knowing the partners that we've had and where we sit now? So strategically, how do you view us in all this as a state?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher. Strategically, a state-led project is the only path we can go right now to accomplish the things that are needed to be done based on the Wood Mackenzie report. So if we were in a state or state-run project, we wouldn't be able to file for the federal tax exemption. Going to a third-party financing and third-party tolling, that's how most of the pipelines are done in the lower 48. So a lot of them go to third-party financing and have a tolling method and a tariff. The producers, their cost of equity is a lot higher than going out to third-party financing. So I think that the model that we're following now is the correct model in order to get us to this next stage to find out if this project is commercial or not.
All right, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Christian.
Other questions from committee members? Representative Johnson and then Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had one question that gets asked of me often, and not so much about you, but it is about your thoughts on the necessity of having a Houston office and maintaining a position, I guess, in Texas and expending our monies there.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, the Houston office, I think I'd probably defer that to President Meyer. What he's told us is that the Houston office, that's where most of the oil and gas things go down, is in Houston. It's the oil and gas capital of the United States here. So having that Houston office and having those key individuals that he has down there, he feels will benefit this project. He's only got one full-time person down there. Everybody else is part-time. So the overall Houston office, I believe the budget for that was around $400,000 through fiscal year 18. So, but he believes that is part of the strategic plan in marketing this project.
follow-up? Thank you, Madam Chair. Back to the FERC for a minute. Do you know offhand when that's anticipated to be completed?
Through the Chair, Representative Johnson. We're looking to file the FERC permit here very shortly. The original schedule was June 30th. We're looking to move that up. Once the FERC permit is filed, they have a schedule of 18 months to go through their process, depending on the questions that go back and forth, before they issue their record of decision, which we're looking for right now at the end of 2018. Once that happens, they issue the draft EIS and goes from there. So there'll be public testimony and everything within that time frame. So it's going to be, you know, a good, from right now, at least 18 months to 2 years before we have the FERC permit in our hand.
Okay. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What do you think is the ultimate goal of the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation?
Through the Chair, Representative Parrish. The ultimate goal, there's actually several. One is to market Alaska's gas, or get Alaska's gas to market, excuse me. Not market Alaska, get Alaska's gas to market. Two is to get gas to Alaskans. Those are the two goals that there's several others that are in there, making sure that Alaskans are working, that we use Alaskan contractors and vendors and suppliers, but those are the two that are the main goals of Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. And so, Mr. Christian, do you see your role or sort of specialty area would be on the workforce side of things? And do you think there are things the legislature should be thinking about or looking at right now related to workforce development?
Madam Chair, yes, there is. But the Department of Workforce and Labor Development is looking at those things. Before I even became on this board, they've contacted me on just that particular issue. How do we train people up in the short period of time? So I know they've got a task team in order. I've been invited several times to speak on that, and now that I'm in this position, I look forward to having a lot more communications around that specific topic.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Johnson?
I do have one more question. This is just kind of a, you know, if we do make it to, thank you, Madam Chair, if we do make it to construction, which would, you know, I hope that we do, but do you see this project as something that's multiple, to be looked at as multiple construction projects integrated into one, or do you see it as one large construction project that you would have you know, one big overview and one large project, if you know what I'm trying to get to here?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, what makes this a mega project is all three segments of the project put together. You know, the LNG plant, the gas treatment plant, and the pipeline. Each one on its own is not a mega project. The coordination between the three, we're going to have to coordinate all three because, one, you want the project, once you start construction, you want it to be done as quickly as possible for your return on equity, the money that you put into the company. So the schedule, you're going to try and compress the schedule so it's most optimum. But the key here is to try and balance the workforce. If the pipeline is not our critical path, the LNG facility is. So the key is to try and schedule the pipeline around the workforce that's going to be required to do the other two facilities. That way you can best manage the manpower so that you're not spiking way up and then coming way back down again. So they will be treated differently because it's different type of contractors for each one. But overall, the manpower, a lot of the same manpower could work on any one of the three projects.
Okay. Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you, through the Chair. Mr. Christian, is there anything that you see the board is lacking that you can contribute, or do you see yourself as a complement to what exists?
Through the Chair, Representative Rauscher. I'm very pleased with the makeup of the board. I think we're well-balanced. We got people with financial background. We got people with labor background. We got people with construction background. So people with oil and gas background. So I think we're quite well balanced. We work off each other, have very good discussions with each other. I'm pleased with the direction that the board is going right now, and I think the makeup is correct at this point.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Christian, it strikes me that you cover many of those baskets, and I'm impressed by your qualifications, and I think it speaks well of the governor that he appointed you. So no question. Just wanted to
thank you very much.
Make those comments.
Representative Tallarico.
Well, I have a comment, too. Thank you, Madam Chair. I really like that during your introduction to us, you mentioned safety. I can see from your experience, ineffective safety program is probably one of the most costly things on any project. So I appreciate that. You know, that's more than just the dollars and cents. There's always that human cost that's involved there, too. So I really appreciate that focus. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Okay. Well, if there are no other questions. Okay. Representative Johnson. Sure.
Oh, thank you. I just have one more. Do you have any, I mean, this is one of those other questions that just kind of pops up, so I'm going to have to ask, I just have to ask it. Do you anticipate, being on the board, would you imagine any time that you could see the line rerouted to Valdez?
To the chair, Representative Johnson. Based on the information I've seen, if we did any reroute at this point, it would delay this project for some time. So this project would not be looking at you'd be looking at a 2030 time frame if we changed locations.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Last call for questions. Seeing no questions, we'll go to public testimony. We'll open public testimony for Mr. Warren Christian. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify? Okay. And there is no one online. So, we'll close public testimony, and then we'll do the motions at the end after the second appointee. So, if we could have Mr. Short, please join us. And the same drill, if you could do your introductory comments, and then we'll do the questions from committee, and then public testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Hugh Short. I currently serve as the vice chair for the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. I was appointed in 2015. I believe it was February 2015. This is my second round of confirmation, and it seems like it happened very quickly. But I'm happy to be here. Just a little bit about my background. I was born and raised in Bethel, Alaska. Currently reside in Girdwood, Alaska. Three daughters and a wife. My profession is running a company called PT Capital, which is a private equity firm based in Anchorage, Alaska. We currently have investments across the Arctic, including Alaska and Iceland. And I spend much of my time working on identifying good investment opportunities across the top of the globe. Previous to PT Capital, I spent 7 years at Alaska Growth Capital, 5 years of which I spent as the president and CEO. Left that position in 2013. In addition to that, from 2011 to 2014, I served as the chairman of the board for the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, as well as the Alaska Energy Authority. And I think since then they've gone and split the chairmanships because that was quite a burn there for about 3 years. It's been an honor to serve on the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. Today we have three confirmation hearings. This morning we were in front of Senate Finance. Some of the comments that I made include that the project is significantly challenged right now. I just saw a presentation by, I think it was the Chamber of Commerce for Alaska, and the confidence of Alaskans in this project actually getting complete has gone down significantly over the past 2 years. Most of the challenges we are facing right now is a significant headwind for the commodity prices that drive the price of natural gas and ultimately LNG to market. With our three partners not electing to move into FEED, that has added an additional stressor, and each of those companies has made their decision based on a basket of investments in CapEx globally, whether you're Conoco, BP, or Exxon. You looked at your spend and you made a decision of what's going to go forward and what's not going to go forward globally. As an Alaskan, we don't have a basket across the globe. We have Alaska's gas. And the point where we're at as a board, I'm very proud of the leadership of our chairman, Dave Cruz, and myself, as well as the rest of the board, to be able to look at the reality over the past 8 months, negotiate agreements with BP, Conoco, and Exxon to be able to take a leadership position within the project, and also look at this project from a third-party tolling perspective, reducing the cost of capital for the total project so that we can reduce the tariff, so ultimately we can reduce the price to the customer when it hits an Asian customer. I think that there's probably a number of questions that you may have, so I'll keep my comments short and pause there.
Thank you, Mr. Short. Questions for Mr. Short. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to thank you for your interest and willingness to continue with the board. Secondly, what again through the chair, how much latitude do you have to kind of take a stand back and look at the gas asset and I mean you have pretty much sideboards on gas line, this is the only thing we can look at, or I'm not familiar with how the board's constructed. Does the board have as an objective to look at other, other opportunities or other means of monetizing that state asset?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, the board has focused on AKLNG as AKLNG has been conceived over the course of the last 4 years. There's been a total of, I think by the time we're done, somewhere around $700 million spent on studies to prepare for the FERC submission. There certainly has been conversations that I've brought to the board. There's a project in Russia which is now using ice-breaking LNG vessels to take directly from the source to Asia. And certainly there's all sorts of different projects that potentially with global climate change, thinning of the ice, perhaps open up opportunities up north. Currently, that's not a viable alternative that we have looked at as a board. And I would assume that we probably would not look at an alternative like that prior to the board making a decision to pause or to discontinue the pursuit of AKLNG as it is currently conceived.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to that last point, wouldn't careful consideration of an alternative to the LNG pipeline as currently conceived be a useful prerequisite to deciding whether or not to pause the current project?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, the process of AKLNG looked at viable alternatives to the 800-mile pipeline, to the GTP, and to the LNG facility, of which there were a number of alternatives. The FERC process requires alternative projects or alternative proposals to what is the primary proposal. I believe that Mr. Christian captured it well, that if we do spend a significant amount of time, effort, or resources on alternatives at this point, we may miss our window, which is the 2023-2025 window to be able to hit the market. My effort for 2017 is really about, is pretty simple. It's how much can we get the tariff down to, how much can we get the wellhead cost down to, how much can we reduce the cost on the GTP, can we stage one train, two trains, three trains, and leverage into the project over a period of time versus building the large project all at once. And if we can do that, can we add customers, buyers, and make the math work? I think that that's the big question right now, is can we make the math work on the large project? I believe that losing focus on that at this point potentially puts at risk the total project. And so my recommendation has been and probably will continue to be to focus on making sure that we push as hard as we can to make AKLNG, the 800-mile pipeline, the GTP, and the LNG facility work as a infrastructure system.
I'll follow up, Madam Chair. And look at the your resume. There's a conspicuous difference from that of Mr. Christian's. So the question is it possible that you or any member of your family will benefit financially by decisions to be made by this board or commission for which you're applying?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, the answer is no. We have a financial disclosure of which all board members must submit. Certainly, Alaskans are probably going to benefit significantly from the construction of this pipeline. I think ultimately that will drive the economy, but there's no direct benefit.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, you operate PT Capital. Would they be inclined to invest in this pipeline in the future?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, the private equity fund that I manage would not be inclined. It does not meet the parameters of our investors. Plus, it's a little big. Our fund is about $125 million. This is it's got a few more zeros behind it. So I will say on that point that the board is very focused on making sure that there's opportunities for Alaskans to invest directly, whether that's through their permanent fund in an election to invest through that, for Alaska Native corporations to have an opportunity to invest into this project. We think that there's an excellent opportunity to partner with Alaska Native corporations, and I believe that that's an important function for AGDC to ensure.
And through the chair, I didn't mean that they would be the sole. I know we're looking for many partners here, and so I just had the just thought I had to ask the question. Let's go there. Where do you figure the bulk of that funding will eventually come from?
The pipeline investment.
To
the chair, Representative Rauscher. Currently, there's a two-stage process going on. We held a investor buyer conference in Girdwood about 3 weeks ago. At that conference, we had attendees from KOGAS, from JERA, and the largest buyers of gas in the world sent representatives to the conference. Those representatives also flew up to Prudhoe Bay, and we almost lost a van load in a whiteout. almost lost a couple to frostbite, actually. Almost lost them to an overnight trip up there. So they understood the Arctic nature of Alaska. Since then, I think that there's been an exhibited interest by large buyers to take another deeper look at the opportunity in Alaska to participate in purchasing Alaska's gas. In addition to that, the second stage of that requires a third-party investor to come in alongside the state of Alaska and provide infrastructure finance. Today, the infrastructure finance is primarily driven by insurance companies, large pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, large pools of money that are looking for infrastructure investment-type returns for a long period of time. and are looking for very low risk for those infrastructure returns. The biggest area of focus over the last 5 to 10 years of large sovereign and pension funds has been infrastructure investment. And we believe that there's a number of institutions out there that if there's a customer and if we have willing sellers, that we would be able to finance the project if the numbers work.
Through a follow-up there, through the chair. You said since that summit, there's been exhibited interest by large buyers. Of those that were part of that group that went to the slope on the summit, or are these outside of that group that there's been the interest?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, the feedback that we've received since the conference, which a couple things about the conference. We initially put the conference together. The conference was 100% paid by sponsors, so we were very glad that sponsors stepped up, including all of our partners. But since then, there's been a number of parties that have asked follow-up questions and want more information about the project. So I think the interaction between those participants and the participants on behalf of the state has led to additional follow-up. These are long-term relationships. Doing business in Asia takes a lot of trust, takes a lot of time, and there's lots of variability in that, but I believe that there is a lot of interest on behalf of those attendees to that conference in this project.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. Representative Westlake.
Yes, thank you, and through the chair. You know, and I was going to save it for comments. I mean, I looked at the resumes that came in here the other day, and I'm very impressed. But I've got to say for the record, I've known Mr. Short for a while, and I know that investment firm that he's talking about. And I've spoken at length with one of the associates here. I can tell you, I wish he worked for the state, you know, but there's more money out there in the private world. But let me say that as we're doing these things, I mean, Alaska is just a one-resource state. That's our problem right now, the way I see it. We're just oil. And we need oil and gas. We need all the resource development. And I think maybe, you know, Hugh, I'm glad you're here. You know, if we've got some real slogging to do out here, and I can't express my appreciation for folks like you that are going to do that, and Mr. Christensen, that are going to take a lot of hits out there, and I can't thank you enough, so. I'm done.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Birch.
You know, a question comes to mind. Thank you, Madam Chair. Recently, there was an REI that I think there's a decision by, and I wasn't following it that closely, but there was a Japanese concern that was looking at an LNG project in Cook Inlet. And is there a lessons learned there? Or is there, I mean, can you, you know, and I haven't followed it that closely, but I'm presuming that you may have or others may have. Do you have a reading on kind of what, you know, what that says or what that portends for the future for the state and certainly this industry?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, I am familiar with REI, and you know, I think the differentiation between what REI was pursuing and what AKLNG is pursuing is they were strictly a Cook Inlet play and a fairly small production plant. So they were looking at about a million tons per year. This project's about 20 million tons, so about 20 times the size. And the gas is stranded up in the North Slope. So I believe that, you know, You look at those, it's a little bit of apples and oranges. And so I would not make any assumptions based on REI's decision specifically to AKLNG, though what hangs above all of us is we've got a over 2-year downturn in commodity prices. We've got a recession in Alaska. And we've got partners who have reduced their CapEx spending significantly across the board. So I think all of that puts downward pressure. But when you get down to the nuts and bolts, I think they're two different types of projects.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Any other questions? Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see that in your capacity as CEO, Chairman, and co-founder of PT Capital, you had current Commissioner Mack as one of your employees. So I think it behooves me to better understand PT Capital. Can you?
Sure.
Can you just tell us a bit more about it, what its primary investments are, a few of the more important
sure.
elements under its in its portfolio?
Sure. To the Chair, Representative Parrish, and the Governor is still owes me for stealing my employee. PT Capital, here's the two-minute version. In 2013, I left Alaska Growth Capital, and one of the interesting parts of Alaska, which I realized at the time, there had been no institutional private equity firms that had been created, run, or headquartered within Alaska. If you go across the country, state of Washington, Oregon, obviously New York, private equity is anywhere between 20 to 40% of the capital in any market. In Alaska, we did not necessarily have an institutional private equity firm. So what I did was went out and raised a seed round of funding to be able to capitalize the company. After I was able to do that, we were able to raise a private equity fund, which is about $125 million. From there, we made three investments, two investments in Alaska, one investment in Iceland. Proud to say that we closed a fairly large investment in Reykjavik last week. We own 50% of the largest mobile phone company in Iceland, which is a deal I've been working on for quite some time, and it just about killed me. But we're very proud of our investments in Alaska. We are focused on continuing to make Alaska a place where we invest. The types of companies, to represent Rauscher's question, we invest into operating companies that do boring things and are in business. We're not a venture capital firm. We don't invest into startups. We also don't invest into large infrastructure projects. That's not the types of returns our investors would like. I employ 9 people in Anchorage. We are proud that we are the first institutional private equity fund to be built in Alaska, and my hope is it's the beginning of much more financial services to be created within the state.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Short? Okay. Then we'll start public testimony. I don't have any individuals online to testify on Mr. Short. Anyone in the room care to testify regarding Mr. Short? Okay. We will close public testimony. And thank you, Mr. Short. I appreciate your time today. And then we'll continue on with Commissioner Mack.
Take a brief at ease before
sure.
we start.
Our remaining confirmation hearing for today is for Commissioner Mack as the commissioner for the Department of Natural Resources. So if you would please do the same thing that the two folks before you did in terms of introducing yourself, and I think we've had a lot of time to spend with you so far this session to talk about priorities for the department, if you want to touch on any of those items, and then we will take questions and public testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Andy Mack. I took the position of the Department of Natural Resources Commissioner on July 1, 2016. A real brief background, my parents met in Copper Center, and they met in the late 50s. They moved to Soldotna, Alaska, which is where I was born in 1964. I'm a proud graduate of Soldotna High School, class of 1982. I went to Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota after graduation. I eventually recall that my wife said that I would like to be married to you, but I'm going to law school. Would you like to come? And I decided that was a really good idea. So I went to law school. And after returning to Alaska, I worked in a private law firm. I worked as a criminal defense lawyer at the public defense office. And more recently, I have worked both on the North Slope as a employee of the North Slope Borough. I then became a resource development consultant. And most recently, before coming to this particular position, I was a managing director for PT Capital. The question was asked by Mr. Parrish, and to discuss that just a bit, I have known Mr. Short for a number of years, probably three decades or so, and he is one of the most innovative, hardworking, intelligent, and businesslike persons I know in Alaska. And he was starting a new company and building a new company, and the business model was to go out and attract investment from outside of Alaska and bring that investment to our state and to generate wealth here and to make sure that all the fees and the business was done here within the state of Alaska. I think it's something that he described very well, and I was a very proud part of that team. Most of my, you know, one of the roles that I played while I was there is I had a number of clients who worked on some of the largest public issues that we deal with as a state, namely our relationship with the federal government and what I would call the sometimes hard to places to get to in Alaska, including those places where there are sometimes significant resources. Those include the OCS, the Outer Continental Shelf, the National Petroleum Reserve, 1002, and other areas of Alaska. And I worked in that that space, and I have spent quite a bit of time understanding how we can most clearly identify what our priorities are and get to those objectives as quickly as possible while working with folks here in the state of Alaska. You know, I view my role at the Department of Natural Resources as a promoter of the development of Alaska's resources. It's an obvious role. It's embedded in our Constitution, throughout our statutes, throughout our regulations, it's probably the priority if you're the Department of Natural Resources Commissioner, is somewhat of a person who can try to see what's happening in the next 5 or 10 years and place ourselves in the most or the strongest position to get there. We also have an unbelievable team at the DNR, so there's a very significant role of day-to-day manager of the department, and I have both Mark Wiggin and Ed Fogles. I think Ed King is in the background if he hasn't slipped out. There he is. And I have a really, really strong team of folks that support me and help me in every way they can. And it's a pretty unbelievable team. And then what I would say is to an extent that the commissioner's job is really the long-term protector of a lot of the important agreements that we have here in the state of Alaska, starting with statehood, flowing through ANCSA, through ANILCA, and all of the principles that are built into those important documents. And we continue to mature as a state. We continue to try to understand the best way to manage our affairs, to protect our interests, to promote our interests, to work here in the state collaboratively. We sometimes end up in court. We try to tend to solve things if we can, but sometimes you have to go the extra step and to battle things out. But those are all important agreements. So the first 9 months on the job have been very, very interesting. The first thing that happened is when I took this particular job, the LNG project was in a transition. It was in a transition from what had been envisioned in Senate Bill 138 as an equity-based investment, and we were absolutely changing gears to kind of refocus it. And what we did is we, you know, along with the companies who were, you know, at the end of 2016 downsizing their teams and bringing them to the point where they had completed the resource reports, they had done the pre-feed process, and were really kind of handing off the project to the state. We also did that at DNR. We had a very specific and dedicated team. We restructured that, brought our spend down considerably to match what was going on in the project while maintaining our core competencies, making sure that we can respond to what's going on in the project when needed, and we can talk about that some more. We also have the budget issues that we're dealing with, and we really appreciate the committee taking the time they did earlier this session to go through our budget as thoroughly as you did. Every nook and cranny of DNR is important to the state of Alaska. It's unbelievable how what we do touches so many people, and the care with which you went through that process was really appreciated. It is a challenging situation. We're not going to we're not complaining. We're happy to have employment for the state of Alaska. In most cases, we're going to do everything we've done before. There may be some slippage in time. If there is, we'll come to you, but that's what we spend a lot of time on. And then the third thing we've done more recently is we've actually transitioned to what we consider to be, well, there's a new federal administration in place, and what are the opportunities within that set? So what have been the challenges historically? Where are we at today? What is the best way to get some outcomes on a whole range of issues from the Eastern Interior Plan to our relationship with BLM on the resource development front? So with that, Madam Chair, I will pause and open myself up to questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Mack. Representative Birch, and then Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. If I was to start a business today in this country or this state, the last person and the last organization I would go to seek counsel and guidance and support would be the Internal Revenue Service. I have been troubled by the domination by the Department of Revenue in our ongoing debate and discussion as far as the oil and gas industry in Alaska. I think and I have the utmost respect for the Department of Revenue, your resources, your staff, the people that work in the organization. But one of the things that it seems to have been, you know, kind of missing in action is, frankly, the engagement that really needs to happen with our, and I characterize them as our industry partners, with respect to, you know, what do we need to be doing on, for a path forward that attracts and retains the type of investment that needs to happen in this state to continue, certainly the uptick in oil, the oil throughput through TAPS. And I'm just, I would appreciate your insight and perspective as to where you see the role and obviously the balance between, the revenue side and the Department of Natural Resources, which is, you're tasked with, attracting those type of investments, putting out the lease sales, managing that relationship with that partner. And I'd be interested in your perspective on that.
Thank you, Representative Birch, to the chair. The Department of Natural Resources has historically and I knew this before I came to the job. It's abundantly clear to me today that we've done a pretty darn good job of what it is we do, which is to it's to specifically manage what are the leases and the units on the North Slope, and to effectively ensure that the state is getting what it is owed and what is due under those contractual terms, those being the leases. You know, through the management of units, we also require some work commitments. And while there's some flexibility, the basic term is, in order for you to maintain and to continue to operate on the lease and in the unit, there's an obligation to the state to continue to develop. The testimony of the administration and of revenue certainly is on another aspect of that revenue base. And you know, we've been abundantly clear when we've testified what the royalty revenues are, and they are very, very significant. As to the tools and the policies that this body puts in place, that, you know, historically has not been and currently is not the function of the Department of Natural Resources to talk about production tax and credit systems, okay? Now, we continue to be big believers in, you know, everything has to be on the table. This is the policy body among you, amongst your colleagues, to make these important decisions. And, you know, I'll get right to an issue which was in the bill, which is the public's ability to know, the legislature's ability to know about what's going on in these situations. We're happy to work with the body and to answer those types of questions.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, RS-2477, what's the DNR's role here, Annie Klutina, and wherever we're headed?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, I think you're referring to Klutina,
yeah,
the Klutina issue. As I mentioned in my opening, one of the roles that DNR has played historically, and I think we've over a long range of time, and it's not me, it's the 22 or 3 commissioners before me, and it will be commissioners after me, understanding what statehood and that particular statehood act and that agreement meant, ANCSA and ELK and all these subsequent agreements. Built into that is the concept, which is a issue here, and that is access, and particularly access to public lands, state lands, and what historical trails mean to that. And DNR takes a very specific and very nuanced view, which is we try to understand what this has meant to us historically, in other words, how these trails have been used, what it means to us today, and then how it places us as a practical matter, but also as a legal matter 10 and 20 years down the road. So in the particular case of Klutina, we are one of the clients of the Department of Law, along with the Department of Transportation and the Department of Fish and Game. And, you know, the short answer is it is our belief and my belief personally that the Department of Law is doing a very good job of representing our interests. And what we have to be cognizant of is that in the particular case of Klutina, there has been a piece of litigation which has been ongoing for 8 years. In a courtroom setting, we would have certain expectations, and we would perhaps prevail, but it is not a bulletproof situation in a legal sense. And we've communicated with the Department of Law what our core and, you know, our fundamental requests are and our fundamental needs are in this particular case. And we've also been advised that, you know, here's where the, you know, where the other party is at, and that we, you know, our feeling is that we are getting good representation in this case. And you know, it's a complex case because it's a mixture of an RS-2477 case and what they call a 17B easement. And so you've got an RS-2477, which is from the Richardson Highway to the confluence of the Klutina River and Klutina Lake. And then beyond that, there's a patch of privately owned land, unowned land, over which we can go to the Bureau of Land Management and assert a 17B easement to get to state land beyond that. And, you know, one of the benefits that's being discussed in this is whether we can take BLM out of the picture and simply have a right-of-way over that privately owned land, the unowned land, to get to additional state property to the west. So there's a lot of details. You know, the governor made a statement about this, I think it was about a week ago, and there's some misinformation about it, and we're happy to try to clarify that. It's been a difficult issue, Representative, because of the nature of the fact and the procedural posture where we're at. So If you have a follow-up question more specifically, I can try to answer that.
Yeah, and thank you. I appreciate it. Through the chair. Basically, how many more of these particular joint areas with a B-17 and an R-2477 colliding do you see on the horizon, or even are we going to be, how many are there out there?
So with respect to RS-2477, there was a piece of legislation that passed the legislature in, I think, 1999 that identified 600 RS-2477s. As far as this combo where you have an RS-2477, which is connected with and provides the access with some sort of 17B easement or alternative solution, I don't know, to be honest with you. I'd have to get back to you. You know, this is usually, you know, the way we look at these issues, and I'll bring up the case of Eisenbeck. So Eisenbeck, there's a federal refuge. We'd like to build a road to connect the community of King Cove, which would very much like to have access and for safety reasons have access to the Cold Bay Airport. We've proposed a legislative solution. At the same time, there's a very legitimate ANILCA Title 11 claim, which would potentially get us access. And there's an RS-2477 claim. And we've kept all three of these options on the table as we've moved forward. And we've tried not to limit our legal options in that case, particularly when we view things long term. But I think what your point is what we're doing today going to have an effect on those later? I'd have to get back to you on that. I don't know the specific answer, Representative.
And through the chair again, mm-hmm. Follow up, and because I'm just wondering the precedent that we're creating from here on, and I was just wondering the department's position on it. That's all, and if it's a little more complicated than you spit out here today, I understand. But I was just wondering what else. If you were you've been on the job a couple months now, and what one thing do you wish the DNR could do that it doesn't have the authority to do right now?
Bated breath.
Well, one thing, Representative Rauscher, through the chair. One thing that we continually bump up against is big, complex, heavily data-driven federal planning documents. And if I could just snap my fingers, I would make some changes in our relationship with the federal government, and I would place the state in a stronger role as the manager of lands within Alaska.
State rights. So, and through the chair, I'm going to follow up on something the representative from Anchorage had started talking about, but I just want to take it to a different viewpoint. As far as the DNR is concerned, should the DNR be approving in the expenditures for the oil industry the way we're positioning you to do? I know that we're having that it was talked about as almost starting a new department somewhat to actually accommodate that. Is the DNR how do they view this whole new idea?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair. The important question is this, is what is the ability of this body as appropriators, as you're discussing all budgets and there's a lot of cuts being proposed, to understand what the mechanics are of some of these programs? And then secondarily, what is the public's right to know if there's a proposal to deeply cut another area of government, you know, and there's another system in play, how much should the public know under those circumstances? And I think those are very important concepts, and we certainly have, folks in the administration have talked about the need for you to know and the right or the need for the public to know, and those are very important concepts. We would like to work on that to get as much information into the system as possible.
Well, I appreciate it very much. Thank you. And I do appreciate the work you've been doing so far. Thank you very much.
Representative Josephson and then Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Commissioner, following up actually on the first line of questions from Representative Birch, who suggested that revenue was dominant, I guess I'm curious how you perceive the interagency operations when it comes to questions particularly involving the North Slope, and whether your department's role is satisfactory in your mind, or how you dialogue with the Department of Revenue about questions where there's overlapping interest. It's sort of an open question, and I invite you to.
Representative Josephson, through the chair. It is an interesting question of responsibilities and roles. And as a owner of the resource, the DNR has this important responsibility to ensure that what is the initial agreement where companies participate in a lease sale and then they are encouraged or required under the lease terms to place those leases in production or relinquish. And you know, we have this fundamentally important role at the DNR of ensuring that the basic terms of those contracts are adhered to. And we do have some flexibility, you know. We have, in certain cases, encountered and evaluated requests for royalty relief in certain circumstances. Have even in certain circumstances, I'll give you an example with respect to the North Star development, the state of Alaska engaged in a process where the operator in that unit basically came to the state of Alaska and said, you know, under the current terms of these leases, we don't think we can get to production. We'd like to change those terms. It went through a legislative process, very public, and it was eventually approved by this body in the 90s, and there's been significant production. So we play an incredibly important role in what is the revenue base from an owner's perspective in the development of our resources. The question of tax is slightly different. And you know, I always say this to folks is, you know, all you have to think about is the fact that you can go in and any member of the public can easily obtain a copy of the leases and understand what those lease terms are. If you just read the leases, they're a little dense. I always read them and think they're written in the 1800s. But you know, you can understand what the royalty rate is, and you can understand in certain situations exactly what the work commitments are, what the timing is, and so it's you know, and we also view our role as being primary. You know, royalty comes before tax, and so we certainly. That money is paid as a matter of contract. How to incent and how much, you know, when it gets to take, that's a separate question. We have, just so you know, to answer the second part of your question, is we work a lot with the Department of Revenue on various issues. I'll give you the most recent example is that historically there was a contractor hired to do some of the front end modeling on the production forecast. We now do that in-house. And Mr. King, who is in the back row here, who used to work at DOR and now works at DNR, has been engaged in that process and assisted in that process of developing what we think is the production forecasting to understand what goes into that. So that's an example of where we work very fluidly now in a process to come up with what is presented to this body in the Alaskan public, which is the production forecast. So we have quite a bit of communication and quite a bit of cross-pollination. We certainly understand between the two agencies what we're doing.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good to have you back, Mr. Commissioner. Appreciate your expertise and things with DNR. But on the Clutina issue, which is an issue that a number of people are interested in my constituency is, so building off what Representative Rauscher was talking about, I guess I'm wondering, as Commissioner for DNR, are you in agreement with the recommendation for settlement from the current acting Attorney General?
Representative Johnson, through the chair. So the way this process works is that we early on in the case as DNR provided our perspective and our must-haves in this particular situation, just like we would in any case. And there's a lot of different elements to a case like this. You know, as I mentioned before, there's both the RS-2477 part of it, and then there's the 17B access over privately owned land. And so we are working in concert with, and we are advising, as the client, we're talking to the lawyers in this case and the Department of Law in this case. And, you know, we had some must-haves, and they were in a publication from, or I think it was a press release from the governor. It was a press release where we identified the fact that one of our requirements was that there be a full 100-foot right-of-way in what is the RS-2477 space between the Richardson Highway and the confluence of the Clutina Lake and the Clutina River. And that is in the settlement documents right now. That we also wanted to make sure that Alaskan residents had access beyond that. And we preferred that the BLM not be in any way involved in the 17B area, which is the area beyond the RS-2477 claim and state land to the southwest along the northern shore of the lake. We also insisted that we have multiple access points to the river. And in some cases, where the right-of-way intersects the actual river itself, there's access to the river. In other instances, there's actually identified places to use trailers to launch boats without motors, without trailers, and then also fishing access. And then we also made sure that there were places to pull out and there was reasonable access for camping and other things. So those were the things that we walked into that discussion with and said, these are the things that we really need to have. And we believe that the discussions are going reasonably well. And, you know, the way these processes work, too, is that eventually they would come back to the clients, that being Department of Fish and Game, Department of Transportation, Department of Natural Resources, and say, okay, here's a proposed settlement. We haven't seen that yet. Here's a final proposed settlement. Do you agree? And then there's a further discussion after that.
Any follow-up, Representative Johnson?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. We're going to go Representative Parrish, and then I see Rauscher, then Birch, then Tallarico.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you again, Commissioner Mack. Now, there's a turn of phrase that we frequently use in this committee, which I think is a little bit misleading. It is industry partners, when in fact I think that they're customers. They're buying the right to our resource. They're purchasing our resource from us. And when I say us, I don't mean the legislature. I mean the people of Alaska, because it is something held in trust by us for them and distributed for them. Just very briefly, a more accurate way still would to say we're two players in a non-zero-sum game, which is asymmetric. But that doesn't roll off the tongue. So would you say that it's more accurate to describe industry in Alaska as partners or customers?
Representative Parrish, through the chair. You know, what we do at DNR is driven by the Constitution and state law. It ultimately can be boiled down to a contract. A lease is a contract, and it's a contract between the developer and the state of Alaska. I want to be careful how I say this, but it is, in most cases, viewed as a contractual relationship that DNR has with the developers, and that probably tends more towards a business relationship. Now, there's, in every contract, there's obligations and duties and expectations built into that.
Mm-hmm. And is it more akin to a contract where one party is a customer purchasing something, or more akin to a contract in which there are two partners with more closely aligned roles?
Representative Parrish, through the chair. Well, I would go back to my first answer, Representative Parrish, and that is that, you know, in every contract there's duties and obligations, and if they don't perform under the contract, then we will extinguish the contract. That's the reality of it. And they won't get the benefit of the agreement, and we won't get the benefit of the agreement. We'll have to start this process again, which is basically leasing our land on the North Slope.
Follow? Mm-hmm. Although I appreciate the artistry of the Dodge, I would ask you one more time, would you say that it's more of a customer-seller relationship or a relationship between partners?
Representative Parrish, through the chair, you know, we own a part of the oil. That's our royalty share of the oil. So we are in the job, we are in the role of selling that oil for the highest value. And that's what we get, hopefully, with folks who are in the production sphere. But I, you know, to answer your question, I look at it as a very business-like agreement, you know. I guess I look at it as a lawyer, where here's the contract. If you want to do the business, you come to Alaska, you lease the lease, and then, you know, we're gonna as owners enforce the terms of that lease, just like any business, if you want to call it a business partner, would. Is that maybe?
Thank you for the indulgence, Madam Chair, and thank you for your patience, Commissioner Mack.
Okay, Representative Rauscher's up next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Commissioner, how do you view our? I don't know. How do we get more mining? How do we get more production? How do we get more, not just oil, all the other resources that we have? How do we go there, and can we streamline the permitting system and all the other variables that are keeping a lot of those that wish to invest in Alaska? How do we make it more inviting for them? And what's your view on that? I don't know of any other way to ask the question. Thank you.
Representative Rauscher, through the chair. You know, it's challenging, and it's my opinion, and I know there's other people with different opinions, but one of the things that Alaska has lacked is capital to invest to develop these projects. And whether you go to Canada or whether you go to some other country, it takes an incredible amount of capital and intensity to develop and produce either mine, you know, product from mines or product from oil production. I think that, you know, what we always have to be cognizant of is that what we say publicly nowadays is echoed across the globe. You know, you see it happening with AKLNG. What we say in this building matters to people who are in the buying market, for LNG. It also matters in the mining world, too. And it matters in the oil business as well. And so we have to just be cognizant of that. And frankly, as a state, there's nothing wrong with healthy dialogue and debate, but at some point we have to talk about the opportunity and make sure that we're communicating with folks outside of the state of Alaska. You know, it's unbelievable in my mind that, you know, the amount of capital that it takes. There's about $6.5 billion spent annually in the oil business on the North Slope, and it would be an objective, or it should be an objective of the state of Alaska to spend that much or more in the mining industry. It's not a fact right now, but it's possible.
And through the chair, if you wouldn't mind, you know, if I had $200 million and I wanted to start a mining operation, and I'm looking at maybe, what, 8 years or something before I can get all my permits, is there any way we could shorten that? I mean, you stick the money in the bank, or you and you hope that you'll get all your permits, and that the commodity price will be actually fairly inviting for you even then, 8 years from now, or you head on to another country. And so I guess what can we do there, or can we do anything?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair. So I think the question is a really good question, and that's part of the reason why we have OPUMP within the Department of Natural Resources, which is to help people understand what the permit challenges are and to bring timelines within a reasonable amount of time. And I think I'm maybe just a half glass full person, but I do believe, in particular with some major oil plays up in the North Slope, that we can shorten the timelines and bring production online more quickly than it historically has been brought online. But it takes a tremendous amount of focus, and it does take some significant resources. And I don't suggest that we have any, you know, magic wand either. It really is I would hope that the state of Alaska is never in a role where it is slowing down the process of evaluating a prospect. I don't know that we are. I think we would hear it loud and clear within this building. I think most of the time we're keeping up, if not, you know, moving faster than other agencies do.
And through one last question, through the chair, timber industry, where can we go with that we might be able to do a little something more?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, we've actually, I was very happy to sign basically the sale of some feet from, or some footage from Kaufman Cove down here in Southeast recently. We've got a couple of other timber sales that are teed up on state land here. There's also other resources, both in Mat-Su Valley and the interior, that I think have some high prospects. And I'd like to get back with you on that to give you a little bit more detail, but I think there's some opportunities there.
That's fair enough. Thank you very much for your question, and I appreciate you.
Okay, we have Representative Birch and then Tallarico.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the permutations of House Bill 111, the oil and gas tax bill, had a provision that basically called for a pre-approval of production costs before they could be written off. And the DNR, as I recall, the DNR fiscal note, which is to describe the, you know, the perspective, you know, the looking forward the cost, it kind of went from inconsequential to substantial. I mean, it was very indeterminate. How do you, and I haven't tracked it, so I don't know if that still exists, but how do you see that functionally working as you understand it, as last proposed through the chair?
Representative Birch, through the chair. So with respect to the section in House Bill 111, which required pre-approval of lease expenditures, we as an administration have talked a lot about the legislature's need to know more specifically what companies are thinking about doing and how that affects tax and whether or not there's a qualifying credit that might be reimbursable. And I say that very, very broadly. So that's an important issue. It's something that we think is important, and to the extent that it doesn't violate tax code and doesn't violate competences, that's an important issue for legislators to know as appropriators. I think the provision and the concept behind it we support. Now, functionally, how that happens, we hope to get to a point where that we can actually understand what people are coming in the door with. The particular provision, there's been testimony in the House Finance Committee that they're going to look at that provision, and we're happy to offer our suggestions on how that can be best accomplished, I guess is the best way to put it. So I think the objectives, we didn't really put a lot of detail into our fiscal note, Representative, because we were uncertain as to kind of what would be required of us at the front end, and we weren't certain, frankly, how industry might respond to this. I think we can probably get some better detail as this process moves along, and we would be able to offer some insights.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And then Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, thank you for being here today. And you had mentioned the Eastern Interior Management Plan, and I know that the administration had probably the same issues that I had with the approval of that plan. And I think it, and maybe you can help me, I think it started out really as more of a calving migration question that came up in the upper Yukon River, and that plan grew to this enormous thing that goes all the way down to Northway, and I don't even know how they got there. And, of course, encompassed a large mining area, a traditional mining area in Alaska, Chicken and Eagle and all of those places. And it walked right over top of the 40-mile river area in the management plan there, which, my opinion, was a violation of ANILCA. And by the way, I appreciate, if we're up to me, we would make the decisions with DNR and let the federal government know what we're doing when you talked about what type of control we would have. And, of course, then they have created a Yukon management plan, which actually the Eastern Interior has the upper portion of the Yukon in it, and I had no idea they would do a Yukon plan since they've already got the Yukon and part of the Eastern management plan. And their Yukon plan goes over Adigan Pass up the pipeline corridor to the North Slope, which it may not have been intentional, but it's terribly insulting to everyone in Alaska to think that anything north of Adigan Pass is part of the Yukon system. I don't think it is. There's probably no Alaskan that does. So I guess the question is, I know that you've had pretty strong feelings on it, and as we work with them, should we? Do you think we should push forward and maybe get a change in that Eastern Interior Plan and turn the Yukon Plan into everything into Yukon, and see what we can work out? I would assume with a change in administration, we may have people that listen a little more closely to what our concerns are on that. Are you going to continue forward to push back on that?
Representative Tallarico, through the chair, with the respect to the Eastern Interior Plan, we're considering all of our options. I think the favorite option, and I don't want to get ahead of us as an administration, but our favorite option is that we would join in part with the 40-mile district miners and in part with Doyen Corporation, who had slightly different concerns but on the same plan. And we would press forward in litigation. We believe that the preferred alternative in that plan did a number of things that were harmful and unnecessary, and included parts of it, actually, we believe, parts of the final preferred alternative were actually not considered in the draft EIS. In other words, they took parts and pieces of the different alternatives, and then they combined them, and then they added some things. And we think it is a disservice to Alaskans on a number of fronts, and that's our preferred position today. So I don't want to get ahead of us, but I think we're likely to end up asking that that be rolled back. It's interesting in light of the fact that the Congress has used a CRA to roll back BLM Planning 2.0. And I think that's headed to the White House, and they're probably going to sign something on that soon. And with the Central Yukon Plan, I was very unhappy with the Eastern Interior Plan. The Central Yukon Plan should make the hair on everyone's back stand up. It is planning over the North Slope, and it is actually planning to the boundaries of the state ownership interest, which is 3 miles seaward of the Minnehaha tideline in the Beaufort Sea. And it is weaving together, potentially, both the management plan, which exists in the ANWR, and the management plan, which exists in the NPRA, with another plan. But it has really significant potential negative consequences. So we all have to be aware, and we have to, they just ended a comment period on March 17th. In fact, that was about Friday or 10 days ago, and it's very concerning to me. And so we are going to do everything we can to make sure that's that works for Alaska.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Okay, if we don't have any other questions at this time, we'll go ahead and open up public comment. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on Commissioner Mack's appointment? Commissioner designee, I guess I should say, in this hearing. Okay. No one in the room. I don't see anyone on the phone, so then I will close public testimony. Representative Josephson.
Madam Co-Chair, the Resources Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointees, Hugh Short and Warren Christian, for the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, and recommends their names be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. This does not reflect intent by any of the members to vote for or against these individuals during any further sessions for the purposes of confirmation. And additionally, the Resources Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointee, Mr. Andy Mack, for Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, recommends that his name be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. And again, this would not mean or reflect the intent by any member to vote for or against Mr. Mack during any further sessions for the purposes of confirmation.
Okay. Hearing no objection to that, we're going to take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork and then switch over for House Bill 155. We intend to go over by about 5 minutes because we started about 5 minutes late, and we hope to get through the presentation today.
In House Resources today, the 27th of March, this is Co-Chair Andy Josephson for the record, and today we will be hearing for the first time House Bill 155 on the Alaska Mental Health Land Exchange. We'll be hearing a brief introduction from the sponsor, Representative Dan Ortiz, and his staff, and then a presentation by Wynne Menifee, the Executive Director of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. The sponsor has come forward. Sir, if you'll introduce yourself and present your bill after placing your name on the record.
Representative Dan Ortiz from District 36, Southern Southeast Alaska.
And hi, Chair and Committee. I'm Caroline Hamp, staff to Representative Ortiz.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair Josephson and Ms. Co-Chair Tarr. I thank you for the opportunity to present to this committee today in support of House Bill 155. Co-Chairs, House Bill 155 authorizes a land exchange between the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and the United States Forest Service. It's a can't-win proposition here. It's a triple win. It serves to protect our viewsheds, enhancement of the timber industry, and also helps to fund the Alaska Mental Health Trust programs, or the Alaska Mental Health Trust programs. The bill itself will protect lands vital to the recreation and tourism, such as Ketchikan's Deer Mountain. At the same time, the swap will make available other lands of comparable value to the timber industry. This will create an upcoming logging projects that will act as a bridge in the industry until young growth timber harvests are ready to be logged. Recall just moments ago the comments of Representative Rauscher is basically saying, what can we do to help stimulate some logging activity in our state? And with the passage of this bill, it would serve to do that. Because this bill will allow for time-sensitive logging, it will help sustain the timber industry, which is particularly beneficial to the Southeast Alaska's economy. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority will also gain resources and revenue from the timber industry to fund programs that serve some of the most vulnerable people in Alaska. The Mental Health Trust Authority provides funding to programs and services across the state that benefit people with mental illnesses and developmental disabilities, Alzheimer's disease, traumatic brain injuries, and substance abuse disorders. The Trust Land Office has been working with the United States Forest Service, communities, and interest groups to conduct an administrative land exchange between the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and the U.S. Forest Service. Mr. Co-Chair, Senators Lisa Murkowski and Senator Dan Sullivan have introduced similar legislation at the congressional level with Senate Bill 131, and Representative Don Young introduced H.R. 513. Senator Stedman has also parallel legislation in the Senate. Overall, House Bill 155 will increase revenue for mental health programs and the timber industry while still protecting iconic lands used for recreation and tourism. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wynn Minifree is here, as you said, to testify further on the bill. I will be returning to my duties on the Finance Committee, but before I do that, if there's any questions that I might answer at this point, I'd be glad to do that.
Representative Birch for the sponsor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question regarding the lands that are exchanged. Do we have, or has there been any assessment of the mineral value or potential of those lands? I mean, I would hate to be turning away another Kensington mine or something that's kind of a high value asset. And if it was mine personally, I would make that assessment. But I just was curious as to what sort of economic valuation has been made with respect to kind of protecting, if you will, the land value that is being exchanged or kind of given up, if you will.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, good question, and I believe that Mr. Manafee will be able to give you more detail in terms of that, but. We're talking about land that is currently under the control of the Mental Health Trust Authority, so I'm sure that they wouldn't be trading away these lands for less valuable lands.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions right now? All right, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you would, I wanted to hear you just repeat that. I thought I heard you say you're sure that they would not be trading away the lands for something of lesser value, but I didn't hear why you thought that.
Well, Representative Johnson, as you know, the Alaska Mental Health Trust was established initially with land grants across the state, and it's through the monetization of the land that they have been granted. It's how they fund their activities. They are bound to act in the best interests of the mental health trust itself so that they can further the goals of what their organization was initially put together for. So in this particular question, I can't think that, if they have lands currently that they are in control of that offer potential great monetization potential through mining, I wouldn't think that they would trade that land away simply because it would go against their basic tenet, which they're supposed to do the maximum potential with the lands that they have been given. But again, Mr. Manafee, I'm sure we'll be able to further delineate that.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Rauscher.
Yes, thank you. Chairman Joseph, through the chair, or co-chair, it calls out on the first page specifically in number three on line 14, and then again on the second page, line 1 and 2, about communities of the Southeast, Wrangell, Sitka, Juneau, Petersburg, Ketchikan. Is this legislation specific to an area only?
It's my understanding, through the chair, Representative Rosher, it's my understanding that the lands that we're talking about, that we're talking about exchanging with the U.S. Forest Service, are primarily lands in Southeast Alaska. In that sense, I guess it's region specific. But again, Mr. Manafee, who will be able to give you further delineation, explanation for that particular question.
And then I'll follow up for you. Then through the chair, could they possibly apply anywhere else in the state?
With this particular land exchange, no. Through the chair, Representative Rosher, if you look in your packet, there's maps that are describing the lands that we're talking about that would be a part of this exchange. And it's my understanding that all of those lands that are represented in those maps are within Southeast Alaska.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
All right. Any other question from the committee for the sponsor? I don't see any. So we will invite Mr. Menifee. Yes.
I just had a brief question.
Okay. I'm sorry. Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Representative Ortiz, for bringing this forward. Just so that we have it on record, although we'll be able to do this, we will still require some action from Congress in order to make the exchange via the Forest Service with the Mental Health Trust Authority. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Tallarico, yes. Yes, the answer is yes. We have to do what we need to do on the state's end of it, but it's not going to happen unless the federal government also gets the legislation passed through Congress. If that legislation doesn't get passed through Congress, they both have to happen in order for this exchange to take place.
Okay, thank you. And just, Mr. Chair, to follow up on that, I think I think the representative may agree to me. I think this may help them make that decision if we move forward with legislation similar to this.
Through the chair, it certainly wouldn't hurt, Representative Tallarico.
And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Any other questions? Representative Rauscher.
Thank you. Through the chair, has this been vetted through all the important channels?
Through the chair, definitively, Representative Rauscher, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've noted that in the letters of opposition, they're proposed instead of federal buyout of the lands, and although that wouldn't create the timber jobs that are one of the primary benefits of this bill, is there something that we'd need to do to accommodate that option if at a federal level it became a possibility?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish. At this time, I'm not sure I'm prepared to answer that question, whether there would be something that we would need to do at the state level to accommodate that option should the federal government choose that option. You're correct, though. If that option were chosen, that might help the Mental Health Trust, and it might help the tourism industry, but wouldn't necessarily help the timber industry, which is the third part of my win-win-win.
Yes, follow-up, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you can stop me if this is addressed in the presentation, but approximately how many job years would this enable if it were to go through? And I'm inventing a term there, job years, as one job for 1 year.
Through the chair, Representative Parrish. Now, that is something I specifically wouldn't be able to comment on. I believe Mr. Manafee would be able to do a much better job of that. And, you know, I think we're talking about making the possibility of land sales, timber offerings more of a possibility, but for me to quantify how much timber sales and all that kind of thing, that's out of my realm, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Representative Ortiz. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure. So normally here we would do a sectional analysis, but because Mr. Menefee is here and we have perhaps 10 minutes, which may not be satisfactory, but we'll give it a college try, as they say. And so on Wednesday, the sponsor and his staff can give us the sectional at that time, and we'll talk about a potential committee substitute as well. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Co-chairs. Thank you.
So I invite Mr. Menefee forward. Please put your name on the record, and you can proceed, sir.
Hello, I'm Wynn Menefee. I'm the Deputy Director of the Trust Land Office, and what I'd like to do is just run quickly through a set of slides that will hopefully explain some of the information. Then we'll probably end up having to do some questions to follow up with some of those other questions already asked. So let me start out with, and I assume you're seeing what I'm seeing up on the screen. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the Alaska Mental Health Trust is a perpetual organization. It's a trust, and as the representative spoke to, its main purpose is to improve the lives of the beneficiaries of the trust. And I won't go reading through them all, but I do want to say that the situation is that the trust has programs that it funds to help create a comprehensive integrated mental health program in Alaska, as the Enabling Act dictated it for it to do. Some of the things it does is it puts about $20 million a year into projects and activities in state agencies and nonprofits and such, and then it grants like $3 million in grants since 2013 in Southeast Alaska, approved $10 million to help fund Medicare, and just a sundry different things. What I'm saying is they put out money to help mental health. Well, they need money to do that. That leads us in to the next part, which is the Trust Land Office. The job of the Trust Land Office is to make money off of the non-cash assets of the trust. And it's also to improve the lives of the beneficiaries. We manage multiple asset classes, and that includes timber as one of those asset classes. We basically act as a contractor, even though I'm inside a DNR, we act as a contractor to the trust authority and manage their lands for them. The lands that we have are managed according to these principles, and the key is making more money from what we can off the lands to maximize the revenues, to protect the corpus, to improve the corpus. And timber harvest is just one aspect of that. We have a diverse portfolio of several different types of things. But the key is this exchange will help diversify our portfolio, it will increase our revenue stream, and it will directly benefit beneficiaries because of that. And it will one of the key parts is that it will protect the corpus by not allowing the timber assets to become devalued. And there is a key part that I'm just going to discuss in a moment, that we have a real risk here if the timber industry goes away of devaluing our asset. You can't sell timber if there's nobody to buy it. And therefore, what happens is we lose revenue at that point. So it's very important that we have it timely to be able to sell to timber industry while it still exists. This is the approximate land holding in Southeast Alaska of the trust. Some of them aren't perfectly to scale, just so you could see them, but it shows we have a lot of parcels all over Southeast. The exchange details is you have about 18,000 acres of trust land that are adjacent to communities, like direct backdrops to the communities, and near Wrangell, Petersburg, Sitka, Juneau, Myers, Chuck, and we also have some in No Name Bay included. But then there's about 20,000 acres of land in Prince of Wales and Shelter Cove that the Forest Service has. The reason why you have difference of acreages here is that's just an expected amount of acreages that are being offered up. It's an equal value land exchange. That means that after they're appraised, the lands are appraised, we have to do an equal value land exchange. So it won't be, in the end, those acreages. That's just the acreages that we're putting on the table, and it is specific to just those parcels. And it's done in two phases. The first phase gets exchanged within 1 year, and the key about rushing through the first year getting a smaller amount exchanged is because we need to get timber to the market. I'll talk about that in just a second. And then when the rest within 2 years gets exchanged, you have to equalize the values, and you might have to shave off parcels and such to make it equal value. So approximately, these are the lands to be exchanged, the trust land being the red ones over there on the left, and then the national forest lands are on the right. And you'll see it's a consolidation. So this takes us into the benefits. The trust land office expects that to receive between $40 and $60 million over the next 20 years from timber sales from these parcels if we acquire them through this exchange. Right now, if we try to cut the timber off the lands that we currently own, well, I can tell you it doesn't go well, because you probably heard a little bit about our Deer Mountain episode about a year ago when we were talking about it. Well, the communities do not want us cutting timber. Now, we're supposed to manage our resources of the trust solely for the interest of the trust. That means you can ignore the public in that sense. You know, if they say, we don't like it, if it's in the best interest of the trust, we're supposed to still do it. Well, we're trying to work it out so we don't have to get to that. We're trying to do this exchange so that we can cut timber where the communities are not against it. So that's one of the things about it. We see that the land that gets exchanged and then we sell the timber, it's a sustainable type of thing because trees grow back. You can harvest it more than once. We'll get revenues in the future, even if we harvest now. So it's a long-term investment. It protects timber and tourism industries, protects the tourism next to the communities because of the view sheds and such. But it also gives timber industry the capability of having timber to market, which is absolutely critical right now because the timber industry is failing because of lack of timber. And the timber industry has multiple layers that has a great economic impact, stevedores, equipment rental, maintenance purchases, transportation, timber fellers, cruisers. There's lots of jobs that are involved in the timber industry. When we receive these lands, the timber that we'll cut on these lands will be done in an environmentally responsible manner. We have to follow the Alaska Forest Practices Act, which has been demonstrated as effective as protecting salmon streams and water quality. Fish and Game and DEC have followed that, and it's deemed effective. So we will follow that when we're cutting. So why do we have to do this now? Well, we've been working for 10 years on this exchange. We've tried to do it administratively, and we've actually entered into an agreement to initiate with the Forest Service to exchange these very lands. The problem is their estimate of how much it would cost to get it done and how long it would take took us well past when the timber industry would fail in Alaska. We're the only ones with timber that potentially could be brought to market right now in any amount that will keep the timber industry alive. Why am I concerned about the timber industry being alive? Well, because if they're not viable, we have nobody to sell the timber to. That's the devaluing of our asset. So we really do need the timber industry to be there so we can actually have them purchase our timber. The Tongass Futures Roundtable had about 35 entities, everything from governments to boroughs to conservation groups, and they all came out with the same idea that this was a good idea, both for the communities, timber industry, and for the trust. As we've worked through this exchange, we've worked with conservation groups and other interested parties. We've modified boundaries and things like that to address concerns. We've tried to make this work out. Right now, I can say that the only group that has expressed concern of any recent time is SEAC, and primarily they've expressed concern about a litigation that they have on No Name Bay. The main thing that I just want to assure the committee is we have clear title in No Name Bay, that we can go forward with the exchange, and there's nothing in the litigation that would stop us going forward. In fact, There was a comment that SEAC put into SB 88 on the other house, and they said in that, we want the no-name bay to go to the U.S. Forest Service. So they're actually in agreement that this should actually occur. Now, they've also expressed that they would like us to just have our lands purchased. Well, that means there's some money floating around somewhere that would meet $40 to $60 million over a long period of time. It doesn't seem to be popping up anywhere. So it's not that we wouldn't consider something like that. It's just that there's nothing on the table that compares. And what I'd like to do is just talk just a moment about the timber industry and the lack of timber supply. Now, in and it's frozen.
Unfortunately, we just have a couple minutes, but, yeah, okay. But we do have the couple minutes.
Okay. This is a map of Southeast Alaska, and you will see, even though the Forest Service owns the majority of the land, everything in brown and tan is what they have locked up and cannot be cut. Everything that's in green is what they could cut, which is a very small portion of the forest. They used to be the primary seller of timber in Southeast Alaska. When they cut back on what they could cut each year, that's when the timber industry started failing. That's when all the jobs got cut. So what we're trying to do is, while they transition to sustainable young growth harvest, we are trying to bridge over the time to give timber to the timber industry so that as the Forest Service can get more timber available, the university, Sea Alaska, and us, eventually we'll have a sustainable young growth harvest that will work, but they can't in the interim. So the main thing that I just want to say is it's critical for right now that we get timber to market within the two-year time period. And that is why we are trying to get this through. That's why the federal legislation is there. The federal legislation does have to pass, as does the state approval. They are compatible. All the bills are compatible. And it directs the federal directs the Forest Service to complete the exchange. This allows us to go forward with the exchange. If both of those pass, we're able to consummate this exchange, get it appraised, surveyed, and timber to market within the two-year time frame. And so with that, I just say we have a lot of supporters. And I'm just going to say just a couple little closing things, that it's positive revenue-generating exchange that will help improve the lives of the beneficiaries. It will help communities preserve jobs, economies, scenic viewsheds, and watersheds. It's timely and much needed, and I encourage the enactment of HB 155. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Menefee. Any moment now, someone, in fact, I think I just saw Ms. Teal, is going to look in and wonder about her room. But if there's a couple questions that folks want to just...
Just briefly, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question I asked earlier of the sponsor, and that was the whether or not an appropriate assessment is done of the lands that the Mental Health Trust currently owns to assure there's not another a gold mine underneath them, if you will. And I assume that's happened, but I just wanted to confirm that through the chair.
Representative Birch, through the chair. When we talk about assessment of mineral potential, it's a little trickier than just saying we'll just walk it and we'll know what there is. It can be buried and such like that. But to the best of our knowledge, from everything that DGGS has published, any of the people that have we've given authorization to look at our lands, there's not a mineral potential that we're losing out in here.
Okay, and I didn't want to deprive Representative Rauscher. A while back, you had a question. Do you want to hold it? Or
my question was asked by Representative.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Menefee. We will adjourn. We're holding the bill, obviously. It is 3:08.